Welcome to the Waite Park Church Sermon Podcast, a ministry of Waite Park Church in Northeast Minneapolis. We do everything we do because we believe life with Jesus is better. If you like what you hear, we'd love to have you swing by and join us for worship. We meet on Sundays at 10 a.m. and have other groups and ministries on various days of the week. You can learn more by going to waiteparkchurch.org.
Morning. Aren't we lucky? We have all these kids. It's just so cool. And the mids. Love the mids. So today's scripture reading is Mark 8:27-38. And then we're going to bop over to Hebrews 12:1-3. Mark is on page 690. Hebrews is on page 828 of those red Bibles if you want to follow along. I'm going to try to use my Kindle. Peter confesses Jesus as the Christ. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist. And others say Elijah. And others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. And after 3 days, rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." Now Hebrews 12:1-3, Jesus, founder and perfecter of our faith. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Do not grow weary. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted."
Well, good morning. Great to see everyone on this beautiful spring day. Some nice rain. Fell asleep to some rain on the roof last night, and that is one of the best ways to fall asleep, isn't it? Well, a few months ago, my wife and I started watching The Chosen. How many of you have watched The Chosen on Prime Video? Okay, a few. We put it off for a long time because, to be honest, we tend to be a little cynical about Christian media because oftentimes it's a little hokey and simplistic and heavy-handed, and so we tend to avoid it, despite the fact that we had had a lot of people say how good The Chosen was. And so, you know, we had drug our feet on it for a long time, and then we finally started watching it. For those of you who don't know, The Chosen is a series, I guess, they're starting season number 5 now, that is just a walk through the Gospels. It's just about the life of Jesus. And it got rave reviews from Christians and anyone in our life who had been watching it, just rave reviews. And so we started sitting down and watching it. And I got to tell you, we absolutely love it. I don't know why we held off for so long. It's the best portrayal of the life of Jesus that I have ever seen, I think. It's really well done, just technically, cinematically, and all of that. But just the portrayal of Jesus is just absolutely fantastic. There are very few episodes that we watch where we don't have tears in our eyes at the end. Now, we're only halfway through season two. And like I said, it's the beginning of season five now, but we would highly recommend it. It's on Amazon Prime Video if you want. But we would even recommend it to people who aren't believers. For someone who doesn't know Jesus, we would say this is a great way for you to understand who Jesus is. People who want to know more about Jesus, because I think it taps into the human longings that we have, the longing to be loved, the longing to be healed, the longing to have a community of people that love us and accept us, no matter who we are or what we've done, and to have a Heavenly Father who loves us and wants what's best for us. And I think that's something that anyone can connect with. And one of the reasons that I think it would resonate with a lot of people today, even if they aren't Christians, is that I think it also aligns very well with the modern script that we've been given from the time that we've been born. For instance, the series begins, not to give away too much, the series begins with Mary Magdalene, a woman of questionable character, an outsider who is possessed by demons and pushed to the margins of society. The Pharisee Nicodemus tries to go and cast out the demons from her, and he is unable to do so. But when Jesus appears, he sees her suffering and he frees her from her demonic oppression and he befriends her. And she actually becomes his first follower. And our society loves this because it's a story of inclusion of the outcast. And I love it for that reason too. And then the focus shifts to Nicodemus, who, like I said, is a Pharisee, religious leader, high ranking within the religious community, who begins to question the religious establishment a little bit and opens himself up to Jesus. And our society also loves this storyline because it highlights the ineffectiveness of stale religion in addressing spiritual struggles that people have. It also resonates because Jesus is kind of playful with children as well. He sees and values them, sees their innocence and their curiosity. You know, Jesus came to do serious business in the world, but he also had time for children. Now, if I understand right, season five is going to be dedicated to the passion of Jesus. In fact, I think the season five premiere is in theaters right now, or it was this weekend. And I'm sure that this will be something, a whole season, that will be moving for Christians. But we'll see how much it resonates with the general public. And that's because the passion of Jesus is all about his suffering and his path to the cross. And in our society, in our modern Western script, we don't really care that much for suffering. In fact, none of us really do. And even more, in this story, it's the nice guy, it's the hero. It's the innocent man who loves everyone who suffers the most. In our script, good people aren't supposed to suffer like that, and certainly not die an unjust and shameful death by crucifixion. That's not how the story is supposed to go, certainly not in our society. Well, actually, it wasn't supposed to go that way in Jesus' day either. The passage that Allison read earlier from Mark chapter 8 is the halfway point of Mark's gospel, which is fitting since it's the turning point of Jesus' ministry. Now, it's not halfway through Jesus' ministry. He had already been ministering for about 3 years, and now he was getting ready to make his way to Jerusalem and it would only be just a short amount of time, and he would be there. But by the time we get to this chapter, Jesus had been teaching and healing and giving hints, at least, that he was the Messiah. But it's the turning point in Mark's gospel because it's where Jesus sits down with his disciples and he has a DTR with him. You know what that is? Define the relationship. Now, the setting is the area around the city of Caesarea Philippi in northern Galilee. It had been the home of a pagan temple for centuries already, but it had been recently repurposed to honor Caesar, the current Roman emperor. So it was an important military and political center, and it was actually the furthest that Jesus would travel from Jerusalem in his entire ministry. The question is if he was about ready to head to Jerusalem for his final days, then why did he go so far away from Jerusalem to have this conversation with the disciples? Well, I have a theory. When my grandkids are at my house and they're getting ready to go home, we do something called a run hug. And a run hug is the best kind of a hug because of all the hugs, including the side and the bear, it's scientifically proven to deliver the greatest amount of love possible. So what I do is I sit in my chair at the end of the living room, and the kids, my grandkids, go on the other side of the living room and actually down the hallway all the way to the end of the hallway, and they get as long of a run as they possibly can because they have to generate as much speed and power to be able to get as much love out of that hug as they possibly can. And then they start and they run and they jump into my arms on the chair and we all feel a lot of love. And so my theory is that maybe this is what Jesus was doing. He was going to Jerusalem, getting as far away as possible to get as much speed as he could because he loved Jerusalem. So, okay, maybe that's not really right, okay? Alternatively, there's another theory that maybe Jesus was going to Caesarea Philippi because it was a fitting backdrop for the conversation that he was about to have with his disciples. So imagine Jesus sitting in front of his disciples with Caesarea Philippi in the back so they could get a good view of the brand new temple to a new god, the current Roman emperor. And this would have had a huge dramatic effect on the conversation where he would solidify his identity as the Messiah or the Christ, which means the king. Jesus setting himself up as a rival king, rival to Caesar. And so Jesus begins the conversation by asking his disciples, who do people say I am? And they're very happy to answer that question. They fill him in. I heard someone say that you're John the Baptist. I heard someone say that you were Elijah. And these are pretty good things to be called. These were significant figures in the history of Israel. And so, you know, they were good figures because they were also pretty popular with the rank and file Jews of the day. It meant that they believed that Jesus was something special in history, not just the Messiah. Now, other people were a little bit more dismissive. Oh, he's just like one of the other ordinary prophets of Israel. Now, of course, Jesus was interested in what people were saying about him. That was actually why he came to begin with. But he was actually even more interested in another question. And that question is, but what about you? Who do you say I am? Now, of course, if you know anything about Simon, you know that Simon was the first one to chime in. And so he said, you are the Christ. Mark cuts it off there, but Matthew goes on to say, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, keep in mind that for the Jews, Messiah or Christ actually meant king. So they had an idea in their head about a political or a military ruler. He wasn't just a religious figure. So Christ means anointed one. And so Jesus brought his disciples to a Roman outpost with the temple to Caesar in the background and defiantly claimed, I am the true king. And the disciples seemed to understand what he was talking about. And so Jesus said, yes, Simon, you got it. And I think he was probably looking at the other disciples too. And then he says to Peter, he said, and now I'm going to change your name. I'm going to change your name to Peter because Peter means rock. And on this rock, I will build my church. And even hell itself can't stand against it. Can we lose the mic here? And even hell itself, I think we're... Now, this was a key moment here in history. Jesus had showed signs to claim that he was the Messiah. He had kind of hinted at it. He had never really stated it directly. But this is the very first time that Jesus just outright acknowledged that he was the Messiah. And can you imagine being one of Jesus' disciples at the time? Can you imagine what it would have felt like? It would have been like, I get to be a part of history unfolding right before my very eyes. They had to be really excited about that, but just when they got their hopes up and were ready to march to Jerusalem and take their place of power, then comes the turning point. Imagine the scene. Jesus far away from Jerusalem. They had just affirmed that he was the Messiah. And so they get up and they start heading to Jerusalem. They're walking. They're on their way. And the disciples have the triumphal entry in mind. In fact, like the real triumphal entry in mind. But as they were walking toward Jerusalem, he tells them this in verse 31. He says, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. And Peter said, awesome, Jesus, let's go. Oh, wait. No, what does he do? I can imagine Peter gets in front of him and he stops him. And he says, why would you say something like that? The Messiah persecuted in his own holy city by his own people? See, Peter thinks through the script he had for the Messiah. Dead Messiah? Let me check. It's not anywhere in my script. It's not in there. The Messiah wins. He doesn't die. And so he pulls Jesus aside and he says, Jesus, with all due respect, over my dead body. That's a paraphrase. Mark says that Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, and he saw that they were kind of with Peter on this one. And Peter was in front of Jesus, standing between Jesus and Jerusalem. And he replies to him. He says, get behind me, to you. And so Mark says that Jesus turned around and he looked at the rest of his disciples and he saw that they were with Peter on this. And so Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Now, I don't know about you, but if I were Peter, I probably wouldn't be very excited about Jesus calling me Satan. Kind of hurt my feelings. I think probably Peter felt some of that too. But Jesus wasn't concerned about Peter's feelings. Instead, he doubled down. He says, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous, sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. Now, this is pretty challenging teaching, isn't it? I mean, in a day when we try to sell things by teaching people how great it will make them feel, and sometimes we do this the same way with the gospel. He says, if you accept Jesus, then you will be so fulfilled, your life will improve instantly, and Jesus will solve all of your problems. That's a great selling point in our day and age, isn't it? And certainly, that does happen sometimes. Jesus has healed a lot of people in the past when he was on earth. And he heals a lot of people today. Many people who come to Christ say that he gave them a new lease on life and gave them a renewed sense of purpose and peace. So it certainly does happen. And besides, Jesus himself says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest for your soul. But then we also hear passages like this, where Jesus is up front about the cost of following him. But here's the thing. Jesus doesn't tell us to carry our cross just to test us. Jesus calls us to carry a cross because he's going to take us places where they crucify people. See, for the disciples, following Jesus meant following him to Jerusalem, where he was going to be accused and tried and convicted and mocked and beaten and humiliated and crucified. And as his followers, they were guilty by association. And Jesus did not protect them from that. And if we say yes, when people ask us, "Are you with him?" then we shouldn't be surprised if it happens to us too. See, when we follow Jesus, our worth is tied to Jesus' worth. Our identity is tied to Jesus' identity. Our goals become the goals of the kingdom. Our soul is tied to Jesus. And so some temporary suffering is a small price to pay for our soul. And over the next few weeks, we're leading up to Easter, and we'll be exploring the meaning of the Passion. The Passion simply means the suffering and death of Jesus. Now, sometimes we have a hard time connecting the Bible and some of the stories there to everyday life, especially when it comes to things like Jesus' suffering and death. Like, what does that really have to do with me? We've heard so many times that Jesus died for us, but what does that really mean? And our typical answer to that question is that Jesus died for our sins so that we can be saved, and that's true, and we're actually going to dive into that more next week. But Jesus' passion also means more than that, more than just the forgiveness of sins. And today, what I want you to see is that when Jesus suffered, he was setting an example for us to follow. That's why the Apostle Paul could write something like Philippians chapter 3, verses 10 and 11. "I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to him in his death, and so somehow to attain to the resurrection of the dead." Paul says, "I want to be like Jesus, to be with Jesus in his sufferings." What a strange thing to say, isn't it? But it's important to know that the suffering of Jesus, that Jesus modeled, isn't just any kind of suffering. Jesus' suffering was for a greater purpose. Paul's suffering was for a greater purpose. He wants to know the resurrected Christ, and he knows that the path to resurrection always leads through the cross. And in the same way, Jesus' suffering was not random. It wasn't pointless, okay? Your arthritic elbow is not your cross to bear. See, the suffering of Jesus was talking about his purposeful suffering. But of course, willingness to suffer does not follow our cultural script, because we try to avoid suffering at all costs. And that's why people love the part of Jesus' ministry where he teaches about loving everyone and don't worry about your lives, because that seems like a really good strategy to lower our anxiety levels. But we don't like the part of Jesus' ministry where he calls us to carry our cross. But maybe we reject that part because we think that carrying our cross is more like joining a fraternity than it is like joining the track team. Let me explain to you what I mean. Sometimes we treat something like carrying our cross like we do a fraternity hazing. Okay, you know what hazing, I know that it's kind of illegal now, right? But in the past, and rightfully so, I don't think it's a great thing. But in the past, what it was the leaders of the fraternity would, if there was someone who wanted to join the fraternity, they would put them through some kind of a test to see how much they would really want to be a part of the group. It was usually some kind of pain or punishment or humiliation, just to see how much do you really want to be a part of this group. And so sometimes we act as though Jesus makes us suffer to gauge how serious we really are about following him. You want to follow me? Really? Okay, well, can you stand this? Can you handle this? But that's not really what Jesus is doing. Instead, carrying our cross is more like joining the track team or the cross country team. I ran track and cross country when I was in high school or in college. I ran track when I was in high school, and I went to a small college, so it wasn't too intimidating for me to just join the track team. I had not run cross country when I was in high school, and so I didn't really know what that would involve. I knew that there would be some pain and suffering involved in it. I just didn't know how much. In fact, I didn't know that there would be days when we would do a 5-mile warm-up run and then run 12 400-meter sprints at 80%, and then run the 2 miles back to the school. And I'm telling you, there was a lot of suffering to be on the track team. But unlike hazing, that kind of suffering serves a purpose beyond proving that you just want to be on the team. Now, there is one way that it's like joining the fraternity. One reward that I had for being on the track and cross-country team is every day I got to spend a couple of hours with some good friends, and that itself was its own reward. Having those friends helped me to be able to endure the suffering better. But even more than that, my willingness to endure suffering made me and made the team better. I was in the best shape of my life. I think my mood was probably the best that it ever was. Exercise will do that to you. And it was that way, because I spent a couple of hours every day enduring suffering. Many times at the end of a race, a meet, or a season, I would receive a reward for my efforts. All that to say, I didn't subject myself to the suffering just for suffering's sake. I didn't do it to prove how much I wanted to be on the track team. I did it because I saw purpose in it. And seeing that purpose made all the difference in the world. And in the same way, Jesus didn't just suffer randomly. He suffered for a purpose. So the question is, what was that purpose? Well, we can go to Hebrews chapter 12 to get a little hint there, because I think it tells us. Now, this passage, Hebrews chapter 12, comes on the heels of Hebrews chapter 11. Imagine that. And Hebrews chapter 11 is known as, anyone tell me? The Hall of Faith. Yeah, it's referred to that a lot. And that's because it's a list of people who exhibited great faith. And the writer of Hebrews says that we should look to that great cloud of witnesses as an encouragement, to look to those who have gone before us to help us to persevere. And with that cloud of witnesses as an inspiration, the writer writes, "Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us." And this isn't the only time the Bible talks about our faith as a race. Okay? And it says to run with perseverance. Now, when do you need perseverance? You need perseverance when times are hard. Okay? We don't have to persevere through an ice cream cone. Right? No one encourages us to stick with it when we're enjoying a great concert or a gourmet meal, right? Ooh, I had to tough it out, right? Now, we only need perseverance when things get tough, when we're suffering. And you know when else you need to have perseverance? When you're carrying your cross to follow Jesus. And so Hebrews tells us that in the same way, Jesus didn't just suffer to pass a test. Why did he suffer? Well, let's look at Hebrews. He suffered for the joy set before him. In other words, Jesus suffered so he could experience joy. Now, one cool thing that we learn from brain science is that joy is relational. The neurotheologian Jim Wilder says, "Joy is that feeling you get when someone looks at you and is happy to see you." But we don't have to look to neuroscience to find this out. We know this from experience, too. If I were to ask you, what brings the most joy to your life? Some of you might say, well, there are some hobbies that I like to do. There's an ambitious goal that I accomplished, and that brought me a great deal of joy. But mostly what you would do is you would point to experiences that you had with people that you love, with friends and family, because those are the things that give us the great amount of joy. Having good relationships is essential to joy. Jesus endured the cross for the joy set before him. Okay, now think about it. The ultimate purpose of the passion of Jesus was to restore the relationship between God and humans. Jesus came to earth to bridge the gap that was caused by sin, and he knew that the cross was the only path to be able to do that. But did you know that the cross of Jesus didn't just endure the cross for us, he actually also did it for himself. That's what Hebrews says, right? See, God is not some being who sits aloof and is unaffected by the life of his children. God doesn't just sit in heaven and say, well, I made those humans and they messed up, so I guess I better do something to reconcile them. Let's give the people what they want. That's not the way. In fact, we didn't really even want it, right? We just wanted to hide. But God desires a relationship with us because it fills him with joy. I mean, remember, this is the God that Jesus describes as the father who sat on the porch watching for his lost son to come home. And when he did, he didn't shame him. He went running out to him and gave him a big hug, and he put his robe on him and his ring on him, and he threw him a big party. This is that same God. And so Jesus died on the cross for us, but he didn't just die on the cross for us. He died on the cross to restore his own joy, so he could look us in the face and see that we were happy to see him. And when we look to Jesus as our example, we understand that we carry our cross also to experience joy. Now, one more thing that I want you to see here is that Hebrews says that Jesus endured the cross, scorning its shame. And I thought, that's really kind of an interesting line there. It's an interesting thing to say. What does it mean? Well, you know, a couple weeks ago, we learned a little bit more about shame. We learned that shame was the feeling or the belief that I am fundamentally unlovable, that I am unworthy of being in a relationship with other people. And so what does it mean that Jesus scorned shame? I think a lot of times our minds will immediately say, well, he scorned our shame. But actually, when you think about it, what was crucifixion? Crucifixion was designed to maximize pain and humiliation. When Jesus was crucified, he was abused and he was naked, he was vulnerable, he was hung on a pole to be ridiculed and despised. Okay? Now imagine what Jesus might have been tempted to think when he was on the cross. Do you think if you were up there, you would be tempted to wonder, what are people thinking of me right now? You know, I'm a powerful person, but they're looking at me and they see me as weak. I wish I could show them that I am not as weak as I seem right now. And we have a hard time imagining Jesus being tempted by something like this. We have a hard time imagining Jesus experiencing shame. The Bible tells us that Jesus was human. Hebrews chapter 4 tells us that Jesus was tempted in every way that we were. And so, do you think Jesus was tempted to wonder, what are people thinking of me right now? In other words, I think Jesus knew shame. But remember that shame doesn't just appear when we do something wrong. It also appears when something wrong is done to us. It shows up when someone sins against us. Kurt Thompson says that to overcome shame, first you have to acknowledge it. You have to understand that it's actually there. And Hebrews tells us that Jesus was aware of it, but then what did he do? He scorned it. And how did he scorn it? Well, one of the things that we know about shame is that shame grows in isolation. And it heals in relationship. And even while Jesus was on the cross, he continually moved toward relationship. For instance, he prayed to his Father. When he was on the cross, he moved toward relationship with God. And he asked, God, why have you forsaken me? He expressed the pain of what it felt like to be in a broken relationship that he longed for. So he moved toward that relationship with his Father. He looked with compassion at the people who were crucifying him and said, Father, forgive them. They have no idea what they're doing. And he endured suffering to bring us back into relationship with him. Jesus acknowledged the pain, Jesus acknowledged the shame, but he turned away from that shame and toward the joy that was set before him, toward the joy of a restored relationship. In the Passion, Jesus is our example. Jesus calls us to take up our cross and follow him. But he never called us to do something that he himself was not willing to do. He also doesn't call us to pointless suffering. He doesn't ask us to suffer to prove how dedicated we are or how much we want it. It's just that when we follow Jesus, we follow him into places where we might be misunderstood or humiliated or pushed aside. We will have to resist some sin. We'll have to deny some desires, and people will pity us because of that. We may even experience the shame of strained or lost relationships. And I'm not going to tell you that it's easy. But like Jesus says, these aren't losses so much as they are exchanges that we make. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? Now, I realize when we talk like this that it can sound a little bit depressing. I mean, who would want to have a life like that where we're carrying our cross? Well, it would be depressing, I think, if we focused on the suffering. But that's why we need to look to Jesus. Because while Jesus did not avoid the suffering, he didn't deny the suffering, he didn't pretend it wasn't painful, ultimately, he persevered through it by shifting his attention away from the pain and the shame to the joy that was set before him. See, we aren't called to embrace pointless suffering. Like Jesus, we are called to turn away from the shame that holds us back and embrace the kind of suffering that results in joy. The joy of restored relationships, when we swallow our pride, when we humble ourselves and reconcile. The joy of giving up some of our wants and desires so that other people can experience joy. The joy of a deeper walk with Jesus. And the joy of an eternity in God's presence. As Paul writes in Romans chapter 8, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. And so, as we carry our cross, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Let's consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that we will not grow weary and lose heart. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you even for the challenging bits of it. We thank you that you don't ask us to suffer without purpose, to suffer without cause. And we know that in this world there is suffering. We know that in this world there is trouble. We know that in this world we will experience opposition, that we will have to carry our cross in order to follow you. And God, I pray that we would be willing to do that, that we wouldn't avoid the suffering that you've called us to. But I also pray that we wouldn't focus on it. I pray that we wouldn't focus on it as if that in itself is something admirable. But I pray that like Jesus, we would look forward to the joy that is set before us, the joy of restored relationship with you, the joy of restored relationship with each other. God, I pray that we would keep our eyes ahead, fixed on you as the example, even if it means that we go through suffering. God, I pray that you would give us strength and courage to do just that. We pray this in Jesus' name.
Been listening to the Wake Park Church Sermon Podcast from Wake Park Church in Northeast Minneapolis. We hope this week's sermon helped you learn to know and love Jesus more and serve him in your unique place in the world. If you have feedback or questions, get in touch with us by emailing podcast@wakeparkchurch.org.